Peak session number 10759, reel 2.
Mr. Anderson, reel 2.
Yes. Well, as I said, from a navigator's point of view, we were extremely busy the whole time, so you'd be in with your head down, working out, because you were invariably working ahead the whole time, working out a course, correcting airspeeds and whatnot. And the only time in the daylight it became interesting was perhaps when you were on doing your bombing run. By this time I'd done my job and we were running into the target. You'd get up and stand alongside the pilot to look out and see what was going on, but immediately you dropped your bombs, you were back in at your navigator's bench again, working out a course for home.
Any other operations you did with 166 that we can recount the details of?
Well, the other one that really stuck on that my mind was one that the last trip we did. We'd been to Rovini, as I told you, the night before, and we'd lost four aircraft. And the raid was a flop, so we were scheduled to go back to it the following night. We were the first aircraft of the squadron to take off. We had 6.5 tons of bombs on board, and we got the aircraft up to about 8. This ripped the oleo leg off. We went down on a wing, and we spun about 200 yards off on the grass. Now, six of the bombs we were carrying had delayed action fuses on them, and we knew that it's impossible, really, to drop a bomb with a delayed action fuse safe. If the fuse is triggered, then the bomb will go off on the time specified. So we didn't waste any time getting out. It was interesting to note that the two gunners used to dress up like the Michelin men. You know, they had electrically heated waistcoats and inflatable suits and what have you. I didn't waste any time getting out of the aircraft, and by the time I'd got down on the ground, the two gunners were out of sight. I was told by the flying control officer in the control tower, who saw the whole thing, she swore that the ambulance was doing 20 miles an hour when I overtook it and boarded it. I don't think I've ever moved so fast in my life. I wrote to Bill Jones about this last year, because I tried to get a copy of Bombard Intelligence, which is now difficult to get a hold of, and he's still trying to get me one. And he was telling me he remembers this quite well. And he said it was about the first time in his life he actually looked up and he saw a Merlin engine in flight on its own.
Why did you come off 166?
We were posted to Pathfinders. Pathfinders wanted an experienced crew, and by this time this really amounted to us with our 10 trips in, because as I said, the casualty rate had been fairly high, and so we got posted to 156 Squadron.
Can you tell me about your crew, who it was composed of?
Yes, the pilot was a policeman. He was probably one of the tallest pilots in Bomber Command. I think he was about 6'3". We had a Canadian, an Australian, a rear gunner was from Cheshire. Flight engineer was a little Cockney Sparrow. He was the youngest of the crew. Had his 19th birthday over Dusseldorf. And we had a Yorkshireman, Johnny Hall. I think he came from Sheffield. He was our wireless operator air gunner.
How did Pathfinders go about selecting people?
Well, they normally, the Pathfinder crews, this was 8 group, PFF, they normally had squadrons that were affiliated to groups. In other words, 156 was largely affiliated to one group. So when they were short of a crew, they'd contact, say, one group and ask for a crew to be posted. You normally had the choice. You were asked whether you wanted to join them, and we were quite interested, so we actually went down to PFF. We were posted, first of all, to a place called War Boys, where they sent you on a course which was practically entirely dealing with radar, where they introduce you to the latest radar sets and also Pathfinder techniques, you know, the various types of marker that you would use and how you would use it, and Pathfinder discipline, which was rigid. You probably know with the Pathfinder squadron, if there was any doubt at all, you didn't drop your target indicators, and you would expect it to work pretty well to about a tenth of a minute. You know, if you were slightly out in arriving there, then again you just didn't drop your target indicators. So all this had to be put over, and this course went on for something like about a month, I think. And then we joined 156 Squadron, and our first six trips of 156 Squadron, we went as what was known as a supporter crew. And in the case of daylight raids, for instance, it was your job to fly alongside a marker crew and draw the flak off him while he had an uninterrupted run in to drop his target indicators. But by the time you'd done about six of these, they considered you proficient enough to carry target indicators yourself. And in the end, we actually did a few trips as Deputy Master Bomber, where we were in support of the Master Bomber who was actually directing the raid.
Can you tell me at this stage what the Master Bomber idea involved?
Well, the Master Bomber actually took control of the raid. He would get there. He would actually be the first heavy aircraft to arrive, and his first job would be to assess the accuracy of the primary markers. These were the markers that were put down by the mosquitoes, under oboe marking. They would mark the target. He would have the job of assessing the accuracy of these, and then immediately he'd done that, probably three or four Pathfinder crews would fly in behind him, and he would advise them on how to drop their target indicators in relation to the primary ones. For instance, if he thought the primary markers had undershot, then he would order the backers up, as they were, to overshoot with their markers. And then he would advise the crews coming in behind and from main force on the accuracy of the marking, and again, for where to drop their bomb loads in relation to the markers that had been dropped on the target, you see. So he virtually stayed over the target the whole time and could quite well be spend 20, 25 minutes actually over the target directing the raid.
What kind of a reputation did the Pathfinders have with the rest of the RAF?
Pretty good on the whole. I think quite often you would find that main force would think they could do the job better themselves. And this might be without knowing the whole picture and the problems involved, you know. And quite often, main force did do the job themselves. I remember that when I was with 166 Squadron, we raided a place called Sante down in the south coast of France. And this, again, was a marshalling yard. And the raid was carried out completely by aircraft from one group who, in fact, did their own marking on it. And it was an extremely successful raid. It took that marshalling yard clean out. On the other hand, in all fairness to PFF, one of the reasons why it was successful was, of course, that the opposition was slight. There wasn't a lot of flak. There were no fighters, and so it was, in RAF terms, a piece of cake, really. One went straight in, bombed, and came out again. Whereas most of the targets that PFF attacked, of course, were heavy industrial targets, which were heavily defended by flak and fighters, and very often other forms. I mean, the Germans were not averse to using smoke screens, for instance, and putting up diversionary flares of their own, you see. All this was going on at the same time.
Did the Pathfinders consider themselves to be an elite force?
Oh, very much so. Yes, very much so. And they were, really. On the whole, the crews were much more experienced than main force crews. They were drawn from the whole of the Dominion Air Forces, and 156 Squadron, for instance, comprised people from the whole of the Commonwealth and other countries, such as Free Dutchmen, Free Frenchmen, Free Norwegians and whatnot, had been posted again from main force squadrons, you see.
You know, I think, about the controversy in the higher echelons of the RAF between people like Don Bennett,
yes,
a great advocate of
yes.
the Pathfinder Force,
yes.
and others, perhaps
yes.
like Ralph Cochrane, who
yes.
felt that each particular group its own markers.
Yeah.
Did that kind of debate or controversy penetrate to the lower levels in the RAF?
No, not really. Of course, to a large extent, Fire Group became a specialist group, didn't it? And they carried out specialist operational techniques. And in all fairness, I suppose, yes, in that respect, they should have their own markers. But on the whole, I thought the Pathfinder idea was an extremely good idea. And proof of the pudding was in the eating. I mean, if you look at the statistics for the raids that were carried out for the whole of the war, the most successful period was 44-45. It was already evident in 43 with the introduction of Pathfinder techniques that the accuracy of the raids were improving tremendously.
Can you tell me about specific operations you were on with 156 Squadron that you can recount in detail?
Well, yes, when we started with them, it was early August, we were still on the tail end of the Battle of Normandy, advancing into France. So quite a number of the targets we did were on the battle area at Falaise, for instance. We did two trips there. We did a daylight raid to Eindhoven to take out a night fighter aerodrome. That was an extremely good raid, as a matter of fact, and very successful, well marked and well bombed. Coming towards the middle of August, we then had a couple of German targets came in. For instance, we went to Kiel, and we were after, I think it was a U-boat factory there. And then, of course, the flying bomb business started, and the RAF Higher Command was still obsessed with putting these places out of action, so we had several trips trying to bomb flying bomb assembly factories, and then, of course, the V2 had started, which was an extremely difficult business, and we were after some of the factories then that were assembling these. I told you about the daylight on Gelsenkirchen. That was on an oil installation plant. So that was a very successful raid. And oddly enough, we saw a Lancaster there blow up, and it happened to be one of our crew, a squadron leader, Raw.
Royal.
Raw, R-A-W. And it was quite a disturbing sight. I don't think any of the crew got out, actually. The thing just blew up. It must have been a direct hit with flak. I told you about the Frankfurt raid. That was where we were intercepted by a night fighter. And as a result of that, we were late getting to the target. He chased us for about 20 minutes. Fortunately, we spotted him before he opened fire, so we were able to take evasive action. But he kept it up, and as a result of this, we were late getting to the target. So we didn't drop our target indicators. We just dropped our bombs and came back. The other interesting trip was on Cleve, which I personally had a few qualms of conscience about. It was Montgomery's advance on the German border, and Bomber Command were ordered to take out the towns of Cleve and Emmerich. We actually were on Cleve, and I think we were about the first aircraft in. And by this time, I'd got up alongside the pilot, so I could see exactly what was going on. We were fairly low, and visibility was excellent. And you could actually see the whole town. And it struck me then what an awful shame it was, you know, that war necessitated taking out what appeared to be a beautiful German town, you know. And you could actually see it from where we were. I think we were flying there as deputy master bombers, and we were over the target quite a considerable time, you know. And
but did you have a sense from that time?
In fact, we were over the target the whole time because the master bomber got shot down and we took over. And it was about the first time that I had qualms of conscience about it, and I must admit, and one saw the utter devastation that a bomber raid could carry out, you know. It was taking out whole streets. And, it was a very effective raid, there's no doubt about it. I've read up about it since, and it was interesting to see that General Horrocks had exactly the same reactions, and he felt what a great pity it was that this had to happen in wartime, and he compared his reactions to that, to his reactions to warfare in the desert, where one could carry out complete warfare, as it were, with impunity, you know, you weren't destroying anything. I was quite interested to see that my reactions were the same as his, you know.
What was the date of that raid?
That was, October the 7th. It's going on fairly late. Again, we were bombing in support of the Second Army, you know.
This must have been the Battle of the Reichswald.
Just the start of it, yeah. That's it. In fact, it was on the Emmerich raid, which was on the same day that Guy Gibson got shot down.
So you had some sense of it being a beautiful town, did you?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think we were about one of the first aircraft there. We were in immediately after the master bomber. And, the picture stands out in my mind now. I could see the wooded area on the entrance to the town, and the town sort of nestling down behind the woods, and you can actually see the red roofs and the outlines of the streets, you know, and the trees, and this terrible bombardment, which must have been horrific for the local inhabitants, you know.
Perhaps we could say at this stage something about this question of the work of Bomber Command during the war, which some people have criticised since the war.
Yeah.
What are your own feelings as a participant yourself?
For the necessity of it.
Both the necessity, if you could take two things, first of all the necessity, and then secondly how effective it was.
I think it was, well, let me put it this way, I think it started off as a sheer waste of time, there's no doubt about that, and probably the first certainly the first 3 years, I think, of the bomber offensive was completely non-effective. When Don Bennett came in and formed 8 Group, I think the thing then started to become structured. It had some form, and it developed. And I think from about 43 on, then I think it was well worthwhile. Now, whether it was handled all that well at the top level, and here I'm not sure it was probably the fault of the RAF or the fault of the politicians. I felt, in retrospect, I just felt that possibly the economic analysis of some of the targets wasn't all that good, you know. I think we could have done more on the oil installations, for instance. I think if, at the time that we were messing about on, for instance, on flying bomb sites and flying bomb assembly plants and bombing marshalling yards, I think if that had been left, for instance, to the Tactical Air Force and maybe the American Air Force, who were used to doing formation flying and doing precision bombing, and allowed the RAF to concentrate on oil, I think maybe we could have halted the war sooner than we did. There's no doubt about it. I read... now, what was the armaments chief of Germany... perhaps you can look that up later. And I agree with his analysis of this. Now, he said, for instance, that if we'd carried out 12 raids all on the scale of Hamburg, in his opinion, the Third Reich would probably have collapsed. I think certainly if we'd concentrated on oil, which I felt we should have done, I think would have had a far greater effect. You know, it's problematical as to whether we should have used a force like Bomber Command in force against a target like Caen or Falaise, for instance, which I think probably could have been left to the Tactical Air Force and maybe the Americans.
I think the gentleman we're thinking of was called Speer.
Was it Speer?
I think.
Maybe, yeah.
The other side of the criticism of Bomber Command's work is that it was supposed to have been immoral to bomb civilians by area bombing. What do you feel about that?
No, I don't agree there, because Let's take the raid on Gelsenkirchen, for instance, that we did. It was an oil installation plant. I think, if I remember rightly, we got there for the change of shifts, you know, and probably caught the both shifts in the plant. Now, they were producing a war commodity. If you get back to my point about oil installation, if you stop their oil supplies, you stop an army, you stop an air force. And I think that's quite justified. Again, you see, if you attack a U-boat factory, as Harris said, if you're looking for a U-boat in the Atlantic, you're looking for a needle in a haystack. Far better to go back to the haystack and burn that down, isn't it? Then you put the whole lot out of action. I don't know that the morale of the population came into this. I don't know that we even thought about that, quite frankly. I know the emphasis in all the briefings that I went to were on the armament side, for instance.
Any other operations that you can relate with that Squadron 156?
Yes, we did daylight on the island of Walcheren, again in support of the army. It was the clearing of the Scheldt, wasn't it? That was a successful raid, and I think one of the most impressive things I saw there was our bomb load going down on a gun sight. You can actually see it quite clearly, you know. We did an interesting raid on Cologne. That was quite an interesting raid, actually, on Cologne, because there was about 6/10 cloud, and as a result of this, we didn't drop our target indicators, and it was, I think, the only time we actually bombed on radar. And I used the H2S to do a run-up with the flight engineer lying in the bomb aimer's position. And as you probably know, we had a bomb tit alongside the set in the navigator's position. And a point I thought was the best time to release it, I did release the bomb load. We released a 4,000-pounder, and I think it was four 1,000-pounders. And the flight engineer reported back that he thought that we'd either hit the end of the marshalling yard or the bridge over the Rhine. And although our photographs couldn't confirm this because of the cloud base, in actual fact, when the reconnaissance photographs came out after the raid, there was a whole section of the Kaiser Wilhelm railway bridge over the Rhine was down. So I think it's a fair bet that we were the ones that probably hit it. I've been back to Cologne since, and I did express an interest to the guide, who was a Dutchman actually, on the riverboat we were cruising on, that I had an interest in the Kaiser Wilhelm bridge, and he wanted to know why, and I said, well, we'd knock the old one down.
What was his reaction?
He thought it was quite amusing, actually.
What were the dates of the Walcheren and Cologne raids?
Cologne was October the 28th, and Walcheren was the 29th, the following day.
You mentioned the navigation and bomb aiming techniques like OBO, H2S, and
yes,
so on. Can you comment on what it was like to have those in the plane and to operate them?
The flares?
The OBO and H2S.
Yeah, we didn't carry OBO. The OBO was actually carried by the Mosquitoes, and they were primary markers. You probably know it was operated on two beams, which actually converged over the target. And when the Mosquito reached the apex of this triangle, then it dropped its target indicators. We dropped similar type of markers, but we dropped them actually on... we usually drop them visually. You approach the target using your normal navigational techniques. If you could see the target visually, then you drop visually, dropping them on the bomb site. There were raids that were carried out over 10/10 cloud, and one or two of these were highly successful. How they did that was to drop the target indicator was a barometric fuses, so that in actual fact they exploded, say, at about 5,000 feet or 10,000 feet and descended onto the cloud base. And then the main force coming in behind would actually bomb on that under the directions of a master bomber. And in fact, this technique very often was quite successful. But normally, if we could, we would drop our target indicators visually, you know.
Were you shot down?
No, we had a combat on our last flight, which was coming back from Bochum, and as a result of that I had further injuries when we got back to, crashed in Essex actually, and it was as a result of that that I was readmitted to Ely Hospital, and while I was there, by this time I was pretty badly disfigured, you know, I wasn't burned, but I had facial injuries, you see, which is demoralising to say the least, I can assure you. And I was sitting in this queue of patients waiting to go in and see the ENT specialist, and this character came in a loud check suit with heavy horn-rimmed spectacles, looked rather like a bookie actually, and asked me what had happened. And so I told him, I gave him the history of this, and he said, well, I'm Mackindoe, he said, I operate at East Grinstead. He said, would you like to come down to East Grinstead? So I said, not our. So he said, well, I'll tell you what to do. He said, get me a full frontal photograph of what you were like previously, and if possible, two in profile, and send them down. He said, and I'll arrange it. So this took some time. I had to wait several months, actually. And I eventually got down to East Grinstead, I think, in the new year of 45. And he didn't operate straight away. I was sent up by them to see an ENT specialist in Harley Street called Scott Brown. So by this time I'd had a lot of ENT problems with infected antrums and
infected what?
Antrums. These are the cavities immediately under the eyes, and infected sinuses. So all this had to be cleaned up first of all. And several months later, when Mackindoe considered I was fit to operate, he got me in, and I had a new nose put on, and one or two other odds and ends.
How did he put a new nose on?
Well, he did a pedicle graft from the pit of the stomach, and grafted it back onto my face, and then took a sliver of bone from the top of my hip to push underneath to stiffen it. It works quite well on the whole, even to this day.
What is a pedicle graft?
They graft actually from here onto here, you see.
From your stomach,
yes,
onto your wrist?
And then back from the wrist onto your face. And then when they've got that in, they then shape it. And as I said, they need the bone from your hip to put underneath to give it the stiffening.
How does it get from your wrist to your face?
They grow it. They grow it back on. Of course, all this takes time, as you can imagine. So I was in and out of East Grinstead for, I think, a period of about 6 months. So it must have been right towards the end of 1945 by the time all this had been sorted out, you know.